This episode of Pod of the Damned is rated S for spoilers. You've been warned.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
So you want me to tell you the story of my life? I'll tell you my story. I'll tell you all of it.
Hey, I'm gonna separate your head from your shoulders.
I haven't been human for 200 years.
The times roll!
Woo! So where are you? The boy nun!
I'm your brother, Sammy! Help me!
Life has no meaning anymore, does it?
Caleb Colton no longer belongs to our world.
We'll give him a week, see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
You're a vampire, Michael. My own brother, a damn blood-sucking vampire.
Will you wait till Mom finds out, brother?
What if I could give it back to you? Pluck out the pain and give you another life. One you could never imagine.
I don't want to kill. He makes a kill tonight.
Michael, they're coming!
Vampire never knew what life was until it ran out in a red gush over your lips.
Don't think of it as killing.
Amen.
Don't think at all. It's just something that you do night after night.
You made us what we are, didn't you?
Check out time.
God kills indiscriminately, and so shall we.
Wait for daylight.
But do not doubt! You are a killer!
I want some more.
Welcome back to Podcast of the Damned. Today, this episode sucks. Because we're talking vampires.
Yes, we are.
I'm sure
recording. Oh yeah, our names. I'm Jean.
I'm Em.
And we are recording from our various homes on the first day of lockdown 6 in the past in Melbourne. Hopefully by the
six.
Time this episode comes out. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, is there a really great pun for number 6? Because for number 5 we had, like, well, mumbo number five, lockdown number 5.
Number 6, I think everyone's just like, I hate you.
Fuck this. Yeah, exactly. I'm done with this shit. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But, so we're recording via our various homes, which is... Well, we've just gotten into that rhythm now, so apologies if there's any audio quality that's not as brilliant as usual. But, oh my God, like, what a great episode to do. This is one I've been waiting for a long time to be able to sink our teeth into.
Oh, so many puns. And, this is also the first episode in a series of three, a trilogy, if you will, of podcast episodes about different kinds of monsters in horror films. So very excited to get cracking with this special series of podcast episodes because
I love that we've left it till later in the daily podcast run to kind of touch on these.
Yeah.
Like, we have waited till we've hit that halfway point, which I think is more masterful strokes of Emma being amazing at organizing, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely it is.
But it's fed my brain in a completely different way that hits. Mm. I mean, because with the films that we're talking about today, all bar one are right up there for me.
Oh,
yes,
as in of ones that I'd seen before and loved.
Oh,
right.
It fed me in such a good way.
I was going to say, all of the films for this this episode, I didn't love them all equally, but I really enjoyed every single film for this
I'm
episode.
I'm really curious which one we didn't like. And apart from
I liked them all.
Oh, no, so.
I didn't like one.
We don't like them all equally. Like, if one is going to be our least liked, I reckon now let's just try. We say 1, 2, 3 and all say which one it is.
Wait, I know which one Shorey likes the least because I saw his rating on Letterboxd or whatever it is. And I was like, oh, how dare you?
Yeah. Yep.
So I know which one he likes the least.
We should save it for the talking.
Because I don't know which one I liked the least. So I couldn't even do the 3-2-1 game. I kind of like them all.
Well, I mean, I guess, we could go around and around in circles, but that's what the podcast is all about at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So which one do we want to kick off with? I know, and this is, all right, I'm going to throw it out there. I want to start with my choice, which was Interview with the Vampire.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay.
And this film, for me.
So we're going to work our way up. Get it.
Well, okay, I knew that was going to be your, and you can get stuffed, Shorey, because it's amazing.
How absolute dare
Exactly.
God.
This, it was my pick because I absolutely love it. I watched this as a kid. I mean, what year did this come out?
This was
1994.
Yeah. 1994. Do you want
me to
do the
IMDb?
Oh, yeah, do it.
I do, but I'm just trying to think, what age was I? 1994. I'm 43 now. What year is it?
It's like 2020 part two.
Okay, so
I was 12. Otherwise,
so minus 20 years. So this is me like 16, 17 or 18, something like that.
I was 11.
Okay, and the reason why I did this terrible math thing live was because I loved this film so much that I went back and saw it 12 times at the cinema. And that was not a cheap thing for a kid.
Wow.
A kid with an allowance and no job, seeing this film 12 times at the cinema. But I think it came out at the same year as Clueless. And the two quotes that I said with gusto constantly was from Clueless, Get Out of My Facial, and from Interview with a Vampire, How Avant-Garde. They were the two things I said for like a year to people.
And, you know what? I laughed out loud when I saw that scene where it said, How Avant-Garde. I was like, yes, this is brilliant.
Yeah, I saw it 12 times. And actually, in rewatching it in a week for this podcast, I've rewatched it 3 times. Now to Shory and IMDb.
IMDb, either way.
Right, what did I say?
I don't know. You made up an acronym.
Some database of internet movies.
Yeah.
A vampire tells his epic life story, love, betrayal, loneliness, and hunger.
Yay.
Yeah.
The other one's about 3 pages long, and I don't want to read that one because that's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, before Em and I start talking about how much we loved it, sorry, over to you. So we can tell you you're wrong.
Yes.
Look, I'm going to – it's not – I'll start by saying I don't like Tom Cruise.
Which is fine.
So I think he's the worst part of
We'll allow
movie.
It.
He's meant – in my mind, Tom Cruise being the worst part is absolutely fine because he's the villain.
I actually think Tom Cruise is fantastic in this movie.
He is fantastic in it, but it doesn't mean he's not. He doesn't mean he's likable.
He's still Tom Cruise.
Yes,
but he's fantastic.
I think for me, it's watching it with the two other films we're going to talk about. Mm. I got a little bored.
Can I ask what order did you watch it? Because I watched this one first.
I watched it in the middle.
Okay, yeah, and from a tempo perspective, the reason why I watched it first
it's so slow.
It's a very slow film, but it peels the onion away really well for me. Mm. Like, even in my three times watching, there are points that I forget constantly and go, that's right. Like, there are multiple times where I'm like, wow, because it's the end of this big narrative, and then it flips, and then there's a whole other direction that I just forget because I'm engrossed by it.
Mm.
I think for me too is that the two main characters, Louis and Lestat, I think I'm probably looking at it more of, we know who Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise are now. We've seen them in other roles and stuff. And I found them just to be a bit, I think two better actors in that role, this movie would have been just phenomenal. And they just sort of lost me. I was just a bit, come on, let's get on with it. Come on, let's.
But at the time, Tom Cruise playing this kind of a villain was a huge shift for him, and for Brad Pitt as well to play such a serious role where he doesn't take off his clothes was also massive. But seriously, at the time, part of the reason why this was mind blowing was because one overplayed it and one underplayed it, and it worked because people didn't expect that. And I mean, for me, yes, there's going to be the queer subtext involved throughout it. But there's something that I loved, and every time I've tried to read the book, I haven't been able to. I'd start it and then I'd stop it, and then I'd start it and then I'd stop it. But there's something that I love about the movie where it shows the depth of the lifespan of a vampire and the realities of what that means, and even the costuming and the realities of different times and frameworks and also the beauty of it is that Louis is a constant victim. He is 100% that character in a soap opera that's always shat on. Everyone's using him. And he's a constant victim of, even at the end when he's talking about, he's like, haven't you been listening? And it's just like, yes, but that's all on you, babe. Everyone else is not having your experience.
I actually adored the scene at the end in the car when Lestat is driving away with Christian Slater, who's just gorgeous.
Love Christian Slater.
Oh,
love him.
And he's playing the tape. The tape's playing of Louis talking through all his woes, and like he turns around, and he's like, "Oh God, is he still complaining?" He's like, "Have you not turned this off yet?" And he turns it off, and I'm like, "Oh, I love it!
Yeah,
it's amazing." And that's really like, "Shut up, of, Louis."
That scene's not in the book, but that is, yeah. So that is absolutely brilliant, and that was a whole big thing at the time where everyone's like, "Oh my God, the scene that's not in the book is that scene at the end." Mm. But it's true. Like he's just so like. There's no winning with this dude. But the reality was the only reason he was turned was because Lestat wanted his privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't, he didn't see a companion in him. He saw an opportunity to use him.
Mm.
And then it just kept devolving from there.
Yeah.
I think what I would have liked too a bit more is the, because the first, I reckon, at least an hour of the movie is set almost in the same time period or the same sort of about 20 years. And I think I would have liked to have moved that along a bit faster. And I would have liked a bit more of them adjusting to, oh, shit, well, we've been here for 10 years and neither of us have aged. We need to get the fuck out of here so we can go somewhere else and adjust to a new climate, have to look a little bit different so that people don't start to think, oh, shit, what's wrong with them? They've been there for 30 years and no one's aged. Just, you know, the little girl is still 6 years old or whatever, however old she's supposed to be. I would have liked them just to move on a bit.
But another part, well, I mean, I get that. I feel like those are expected narrative tropes though, like when we're using the narratives that we see every single time and the idea of, but why wouldn't people be like, they haven't aged or anything like that? It's not like they're on Facebook, do you know what I mean? Like
reality, but people still notice,
but that's one of the things that I kind of love about it, when everyone's like, oh, there's the plague, there's death, and it's all these things within history, and it really was just them, you know. Even the narrative of, oh, and then people started to get sick, when we know they're killing them on the boat, like that's what's going on. And but one of the things I loved in communicating with Em was, Em at the start when we were watching it and messaging was like, oh my God, there's an actual interview with a vampire.
Because I had never seen it before, and I just happened to watch it the same night as Dean. We were just texting and we were both watching Grey's.
Well, you had a pretty good shot at watching the same night as Dean, because you watched it, what, 7 times again this time?
Well, this is true. And I said, I'm going to watch Interview after this. And he was like, oh, yeah, me too. Let's watch it together. So, I'd never seen it. So I don't know. I thought Interview with the Vampire was like a metaphor for something. Like I knew it was about a vampire, but I just thought the interview thing was a metaphor. And then I was like, oh, no, it's an actual interview with the vampire. It's a legit interview, yeah. Okay, get it. Very literal title. But I, you know, like I do understand what you're saying about it being slow. But I think that sometimes this is what happens when a movie tries to faithfully adapt a book or a novel, because often they do span long periods of time. And I think especially given the genre, I think the point was to convey, as Dean was saying, that longevity and the experience of being a vampire and how you are just time keeps moving, but you don't. You're just sort of still, and it just kind of the decades just wash past you, and you really got a sense of that happening. And it, look, I do see.
And while everyone else embraced it, Louis just didn't. Like that's the thing.
Yeah,
there are only so many times I could hear how he eats rats, though. Like that got a bit. You know, every sort of 20 minutes or so, they reiterated that he ate rats, and I was like, we get it, man. Come on, we've been watching.
Louis the frustrated me. I was just eat a person.
He's not the hero of the story. This is one of the reasons why I love this. Like Louis's not the hero of the story. You're rooting for every other character who are actually the villains in the story, if you're looking at it from those two tropes. But you're actively rooting for them because you're like, come on, you're a vampire. Like, what the hell? And this when he eats the dogs instead of the woman, and it's a really interesting point that gets brought up. And I realize in all three of these films, at no point do they say you need to drink blood. They all say you need to kill. So it's not about feeding your hunger. It's about ending a life. And it's just that really interesting thing of, if someone turns immediately, the first thing you don't say to them is, the only way you can survive is to kill people. So one of the things I like about this film is that killing them is actually about that feeding of hunger for you and that need. And I mean, it's feeding that instinct. Yeah. And it's also like the realities of, you know, I just love the relationship and brotherhood and connection over time. And Kirsten Dunst, this was her first big film role. And I think it was the first role she ever played. She won an Academy Award for it.
She was
nominated, maybe. I don't know if she was.
I thought she won. I thought she won.
I don't think she's won an award.
Or she was like, it was huge. And when you look at what she played and how she played it, like, it's huge, you know, being a young child and then being a mature woman trapped in the body of a young child. And
wasn't even nominated.
Oh, wow.
She was Golden Globe. She was nominated
Golden
for
Globe,
not
Golden Globe, sorry. Okay, Golden Globe, Golden Globe. And was just so brilliant. And that whole thing of the fear of the sunlight and when they go to, where do they go to? From New Orleans to probably Europe, I don't know. But it was a new world, not Australia. But and then when, you know, it's a whole new world.
Sun in Australia.
He's trying to keep her in check. There's so much to it, like the reality of when they're scolding her and treating her like a child. Because but the reality is that she's been so old for so long. But there's so many dolls and a dead body underneath all the dolls. And they, because they're treating her like a child because she looks like a child, but her mind is nothing like
that.
Well,
and just the ignorance that they could think that they could turn a child and then just sort of have this eternal child to take care of. Like, they surely they would understand that she's going to mentally age because she's going
to... It's that whole narrative of the only reason why Lestat turned Louis was to get his stature and status. Like he wanted, and that's why he would always be annoyed whenever he would threaten, you know, this is our home, why would you do this? Because he just wanted the things. Then he's stuck with this guy that's being this way. So to appease the bullshit that he has to deal with, let's give him a child. Then he's having a lot of fun with the child. And it's, I love, like, Tom Cruise is fantastic in the way he plays this, where in scolding her and everything, and she's just like, but isn't that what we're meant to be doing? And it's not because she's a child, it's because why the hell not? And it's really interesting that he's a character that constantly needs to control things, but he turns to people that he has no control over, for either of them in any way, shape or form, and neither of them are doing, and it makes me wonder about the relationship he had with his sire. Because he assumed, in my opinion, with all of this turning, that things would be completely different to what they were. And then they weren't. And it came back on him in this massive way where they, well, she killed him, or so they thought. And it's just great then when it turns again and now their life was better, we're in a new world, and they suddenly find this army of vampires who are like play and what and that's the thing, it's like, and we're actors, so we travel around, we do these things. And how amazing was that scene where there's the audience watching and they kill a woman in front of the audience and the audience think they're watching a show. And it's a very smart and I guess that's the thing I love about it is the way in which it portrays these elements of these things. It's really smart for the times and for the realities of how it could have happened.
I wanted more of that, the Antonio Banderas' troop. I wanted more of them. I found that fascinated me, that they would, like, did they stay there? Did they travel? I wanted to know more about them. And it was sort of, because we'd spent so much time, like the first hour or so in New Orleans in America. Kind of. But that second, like, I felt like that was really rushed over. And I would have rather had, you know, 30 minutes in New Orleans and a bit more in France or wherever they were with that.
You're not wrong. A little bit more time, because time had grown so much. The thing of it, because they were in New Orleans, but you're also forgetting that the larger chunk of time they had was in New Orleans. Like, like, it's that whole thing of, was it a doll every year?
Yeah.
She's got, like, there was about 170 to 100 dolls. Like, and it's that thing of like, okay, and they were still in New Orleans where we set our scene.
And so, also, you've got to remember the story is about Louis and Lestat, so that troop of vampires that they find are only ever really there to serve the stories of the main characters, which is why I think we don't see heaps or see more of them, because it's there to serve a purpose to understand more about the story of these other vampires. But I do agree that they were fascinating. Like,
Totally. And I mean, the thing I always find interesting when I watch it is when you are a troop, when you're a group of vampires and they go, these are our fixed rules, you never harm another vampire. And I'm like, cool, but that doesn't mean everyone else abides by your rules. And that's the interesting thing of it, where they didn't have a conversation about it. They made a decision. They go, well, they killed another vampire. We need to get rid of them. They don't kill them themselves, but they orchestrate a scenario where they are killed.
It's the Punisher. You're trying to get rid of killers, so you kill killers.
But it's that interesting double-edged sword where in doing that, because they think that's justice, and the way, and that's their rules, and they assume everyone has to live by their rules, that it's their own undoing. It's also that amazing, like, I love when obviously Antonio Banderas and Louis, they're gonna, you know, move on, and he's found a kinship that he never had with Lestat, and Kirsten Dunst's, what was her character's name?
Hang on, I got it.
Where are we?
It was Claudia.
Claudia. And I love what I've always loved about the scene where she's like, you found someone, now let me have this. And it's a woman who's lost her child, yearning for a mother. So she's found a way within this relationship of what she's always going to be able to give herself something. Yes. And it's that final point where he does something he promised he would never do and kind of hates her for it. And then it's totally their undoing. Like, what possible reason was there to kill the woman? But the troop decide that's what's going to happen. Well, like, it's where he finally, every time he succumbs to his inner nature, this is the interesting thing about Louis. Every time he succumbs to the true nature of what he now is, it goes wrong. He finally, you know, bites a young girl, and because he feels tormented by it, Lestat turns him. He finally turns another vampire, and because Claudia had killed, like, then literally 24 hours later, they're both killed. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Every, like, no wonder he's such a mess of a human being. But what I love as well is he's not the hero of the story. Like, it's just, and amazing with the sunlight and them scared of it and then they turn to ash and the beauty of that scene. And the I loved watching him just burn down the entire place. It was fantastic and beautiful. And I always laugh every single time when he sees the sunrise. And finally, we come to the 80s and he sees the Superman film and Superman fly around the sun. And every time I'm like, and he's like, and then I saw sunlight in color. And it's like, oh, at that point, I do what Lestat does at the end of the film. My eyes roll. But I always forget that Lestat's not dead. So every time he finds Lestat again in New Orleans, when he's, you know, and I imagine Lestat being hiding away after all these years and not being able to move and being scared of the light of a helicopter that's shining in the window for some reason. Like, there's something about that. There's something about that that I love, because it's just like, oh my God, like, what a change your life has taken from that moment when they killed, well, they thought they killed you. And he's just a mess. But I always forget every time I watch the film that that scene's there. So I'm always surprised that he's still alive.
I do really like the way they did the passage of time towards the end by showing movies, like doing something that everyone can relate to. Yeah. So we see that he, you know, he goes to the movies and that pushes the time forward because he's going from black and white film to color to special effects and everything.
And you're right, the pacing could have absolutely used it. Em, do you want us to stop and restart the Zoom if your internet's playing?
I think we're back.
You look fine now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just thought you were being really pensive.
No, I was just, everything kind of went weird and frozy.
No, you're all right, like, now.
Okay, cool.
But sure, he's not wrong. Like, the pacing is slow, but it's a very...
I definitely missed a lot if when I came back, the first thing you say is, sure, he's not wrong. I mean, I don't
know. No. Like, I mean, because we were talking about the end.
Put it on a T-shirt.
Like, I was having my Lestat going on and on, exciting, saying, like, loved it at that point. And I always forget that Lestat actually is back in the story. Like, I always forget it. But it's this thing as well where, you know, like, and then the pacing of the movies and the showing of the passing of time that way and what that means, it races everything up. And but it's a different type of vampire story. It's a different type of horror. And I just love the dark. And I mean, imagine as a young queer kid watching this and seeing, like, I mean, if any horror genre is subtext with queerness, it's vampires. Like,
absolutely. I adored it. And I agree with what you're saying, Dean. It's just a different kind of vampire movie. Like, I don't think I think the pacing is spot on for this kind of movie. I think this is what it needs to be, and it works for this film. And completely understandable if it's not for everyone. I really enjoyed it. I found it so just so camp and, you know, like, dramatic, and I just adored that. And as much as, look, I actually don't mind Tom Cruise as an actor. I don't like him as a person, but I thought that he was perfect in this. I also thought Kirsten Dunst was just
amazing.
Unbelievable.
Like, Kirsten Dunst was good. I'm not a huge fan of her, but she was good.
It does make you realize you should watch Bring It On. It does make
you realize. I love Bring It On. Don't you dare question my Bring It On life.
Except there's no comfortable way.
This is a cheerocracy.
There's no way that she can clean her teeth in a film without it looking uncomfortable. But but that's the thing where this film showed me where I'm like, I agree with you on the whole. No, Tom Cruise as the person that we see, I don't like. But the reality of it, though, is this made you realise, and I'm not trying to use the sink your teeth into analogy again, but give certain actors a role like this that they can sink their teeth into and they rise. It was like he took inspiration from John Travolta and Nick Cage in Face Off and used it for this film. Like it's very inspiring with these two really strong people that are able to deliver this energy and tone that just nails it.
Well, it's like that manic Tom Cruise energy is perfect for this role. It's like you almost watch it and it almost seems a little bit like it's just Tom Cruise being Tom Cruise.
Totally.
It's just perfect for this role.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean,
one of my favourite bits is in the car at the end and he's puffing out his sleeves and you're just like, he's still wearing that shirt and jacket. Like, this is this crazy ass character. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. Like, the passing of time may have changed, but he hasn't.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
And it's great.
It is a great.
Yeah. And who doesn't love Christian Slater? And Christian Slater.
Love Christian Slater. He needs to be in more things.
This is slightly off topic, but I recently watched all of Dr. Death on Stan.
I didn't watch that.
Yeah, and Christian Slater is in that, and he's fantastic, awesome. Absolutely fantastic, and it really got me thinking about him again.
So just stay off that tangent for a second. Were you the person that asked online, should I watch the series, the documentary, the podcast, which one should I watch first? Was that you?
No, it was
not. No, okay, cool.
I've watched the series. I haven't listened to the podcast yet or watched the documentary. But
you recommend series watching?
Yeah, the series is really good. It's hard. Don't get me wrong. Like it's confronting and it's hard to watch. It's really well done in that you watch it and you're like, fuck, mate. Like you just really, because it's very, very, it's a very faithful recreation of what actually happened. They use some poetic license, but it's a fairly faithful recreation of what this guy did. And
it's pacey.
Yeah. And Joshua Jackson is amazing in this role. I'm just like, whoa, I did not know you had this in you. it's really good but confronting.
Okay, cool. Yep. All right, well, that's absolutely on my list.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, Shori, you just didn't like Interview with a Vampire. We're just going to have to leave it at that.
It's not for me, but that's all. I don't care that anyone else likes it. It's not a movie for me. And, you know, we sort of, if we want to, do you want to move into the my selection for the next
one? That was absolutely where I want to move into, because now I get to flip it where I had such high hopes for this film.
Oh.
Such high hopes for this film.
Wow.
And I was like, come on, cowboys and vampires. This sounds like it's totally up my alley because I love both. And then I was just like, wait, what? For lots of it.
Oh, wow.
So this was my selection. It's Near Dark, which is my favorite vampire movie. It's a small town farmer's son reluctantly joins a traveling group of vampires after he is bitten by a beautiful drifter. And look, I have an unabashed love for Bill Paxton and Lance Henriksen. Right?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I think the thing that killed me is they were the only characters to have any character progression.
Yeah.
And everyone sat within a very specific tone that when you see in Westerns or even in horror films, they don't get as much screen time as these characters got.
Mm-hmm.
So these actors were literally working one note for ages.
Yeah,
and the whole film. And that's what was killing me, where I'm looking at these scenes and I'm looking especially the one at the bar and I'm like, this is so cool, except it's not quite landing for me. And that's my thing with this one, where I was just like, oh, I feel bad for them because it's the directing. Like, everyone's bringing it.
It's Catherine Bigelow too. Like, Catherine Bigelow, who went on to win an Oscar for The Hurt Locker and was James Cameron's partner for such a long time. And, I think this for me, like, you look at the three movies we've got. We've got the Interview with a Vampire, which is the, you know, camp, puffy sleeves, cello music, chamber music sort of thing. This is more like the punk rock, heavy metal sort of, you know, angry vampire movie.
Very perfect for its time. Like, very perfect.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And what I did love about it as well is it's a Western. Like,
yeah. Yep. Scenes with him riding horses and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, like, thematically, they very much go, we're going to take this vampire thing and put it in this setting. And I think, and that was the thing that I was okay with, is the fact that when you're looking at a Westing and you're looking at this kind of tone, the story fits a certain narrative. And I'm pretty sure at times they were pushing against each other, but they kept that going.
Well, and I love too that, you know, you look at Westerns, and Westerns are usually bright and in the sun and deserty plains and everything.
Yeah.
And so it sort of flips it where these people have to try and survive in a desert town. So they've got a camper van with foil over the windows and everything covered so they can't get out, and they run around with, you know, coverings
really
over them.
It's smart. It's really smart.
It's a really clever movie.
Which apparently Elroy was telling me, because he also loves this movie, apparently Joss Whedon was influenced by those scenes where they have the foil covering the windscreens of the car, and that's where he got the idea in Buffy where Spike has his car with the stuff all over the windows so that he can drive his car even when it's light outside. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
It's smart. It's really smart. And I mean, it brings a whole different level to it.
I mean, I have to admit, I loved the cast, and I did fall in love with the gang of vampires in this, like, you know, Bill Paxton, and I've forgotten her name, but Vasquez from Aliens and a bunch of other films. Jeanette.
The mum vampire's hair was amazing.
Jeanette Goldstein.
I love again this notion of a younger vampire, and we get a younger body, and we get a glimpse into and a sense of just the struggles of being, you know, an old soul, literally, in this really young body. I do see what you're saying, Dean, like, especially Caleb, his character was so flat and so one note. He was the most boring character to watch. And even May, his love interest, I was like, eh. But
the point to them all, they were all juxtapositions to this other narrative.
Yes.
Like, I understand that completely. Like, all of them were juxtapositions to this other narrative. And my thing with that is, that's fine, except that you are just as main cast members as
they
are.
Yeah, they just got too much screen time.
I didn't need a lot of level. Yeah. I just needed a little bit more, because it was literally season one Buffy, everyone's a villain kind of thing. Every vampire's just bad. And especially when you think of it, like, they are traveling together and there is this family dynamic. And even when the father vampire calls the little kid vampire, old man, keep it together. And there's this brilliant dynamic. And it was a movie that was also playing with family, because you've also got Bill Paxton's family trying to find him.
And exactly.
I love that. I love that push and pull.
Yeah.
And they got more narrative than, like, his human family got more narrative than his vampire family. And I guess that's what killed me a little bit, where I'm like, they just needed a little bit, because they weren't evil. Do you know what I mean? They were vampires living in the desert.
The boss thing says otherwise. I
was about to say, they're not exactly choosing the most humane methods of
I guess it's that thing where I'm just
kind of
like...
They are sadistic.
But in a Western, they are sadistic, but that's my thing. In a Western, like, that's the narrative. You know what I mean? Like I don't need them to be full circle or anything, but you've got to have the heroes, you've got to have the villains. It's just the way that it rolls. And I love, was blowing my mind. Like, that was amazing to watch. The cops are shooting, you know, holes in, and the holes have sunlight shining through, and then it's burning them. It's fantastic the way they do it all.
It was really good. One thing I was thinking watching this, because I already watched the other, this was the last film that I watched. I'd seen it before, but just sort of rewatched it. I'm now curious, like, having watched three vampire movies close together, about why is it, as a viewer, right, when we watch vampire movies, someone gets bitten and they're, you know, usually typically the good guy and they've been bitten by a vampire. Why is it, as the viewer, that we desperately want them to go and feed on a human? Like, you feel frustrated. This is a common theme, right? Yeah, it's a common theme of the human who's been bitten resisting. They don't want to feed. I suddenly realized, I was like, we always are frustrated in that. We want them to feed. Why? Do we think we would be different in that situation? Like, why are we so eager for them to give up their humanity? But we are. Like, you're watching it and you're like, just feed.
Because it's a vampire film, and that's what you're meant to do. Like, the point is, you're meant to eat. Like, do it.
But why don't we relate to them and go, oh, God, like, yeah, that would be hard. Like, feeding on human flesh. Like, why is it we so desperately want them to give into it? I don't know if it's this, like...
like,
Jungian psychology, like I'd we're being tempted by the dark side. Do you know what I mean? But it's like where I almost wonder if it's like this, it's a form of catharsis. Like this is the closest, watching these films, we have the opportunity to connect to the very, the darker side of our human nature in a safe way, because we get to watch the everyday Joe, who we're meant to align ourselves with, become a monster and get to give in to these dark urges and feed on other humans. And I wonder if it's like this sort of cathartic experience. So we want them to do it so that we can live vicariously through them.
Maybe, like it's that thing where, I don't know, I mean, it's expected. You're a vampire now. It's what you've got to do. Like you've just got to.
Yeah, maybe it is just that. It's just the frustration of, like, what else are you going to do?
I mean, but that's the thing I love about these three films is that was a part that each of the characters went through, but it wasn't the narrative of the films or the tone of it. Like, of course, they have that struggle. Everyone struggles, but once you accept your true nature, then you're laughing.
And I suppose maybe part of the reason it's literally also just a plot device. Like, it serves to create tension in the narrative because – you know, as they're going on, like every time he doesn't feed, he gets really sick, and then May has to decide whether she's going to keep sacrificing her blood to feed him, which is, I hate his relationship with women. This
it's
character.
Terrible.
I'm like, oh, my God, even in the car at the start, I'm watching it, him being like, not going to let her get out of the car until she kisses him, and then she bites him. And I literally said at the screen, well, that's what you get when you don't let a woman leave your car unless she kisses
you. But also
him,
when he lassos her, and it's just like, oh,
I know.
God.
It's so gross. I'm like, nah, dude, you deserve everything that's coming. Like,
You know the thing that killed me, though, when it flips towards the end and there's, like, the way he de-vampires?
Well, I find this fascinating because I've never seen anything like this in a vampire movie before. So for me, it's part of
there's
what makes this film stand out. Well, yeah, I don't know that I like it, but it's definitely unique. I've never seen that before, but I feel like there's something, again, cathartic about the full circle experience in a vampire movie of watching someone go through, because it's a metaphor, watching someone go through pain and struggle and resistance and denial, and then finally accepting yourself and embracing who you really are, both the light and the dark side. But in this case, he sort of, it was like rather than grow into who he was becoming, he kind of took a step back and that feels unnatural to do, and then dragged her back with him.
I don't know if he dragged her back.
Well, no.
Well, her family were all dead by that point too, though.
Yeah.
I meant sort of metaphorically, not like, he didn't sort of force
you know,
her to
one
do
of
that,
the things that drove me insane is in the bar scene where they're slowly slaughtering everyone. Like, oh, my God, get on with it. and there's the guy behind the bar who pulls out, opens the drawer, gets the gun, fiddles with the things. And I'm like, you're a terrible barman in any kind of country town if you don't have that shotgun lock and loaded already. Like, come on.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But I did really, like, even though I'm seeing some of these frustrating aspects to this film, I can't deny I really enjoy this film. And it may just be the cast, like that gang of vampires. I love the casting of nearly every single member. It's one of those, there are some, like, it's almost an ensemble cast. There are some casts that you just enjoy watching. Even if the movie's not perfect, you just really love watching them.
True.
And I love Lance Henriksen. I'll watch him in almost anything. And Bill Paxton is fantastic as your quintessential, I feel like there's always that one vampire in vampire films that is just batshit insane, that seems like he's just on coke constantly.
Yeah.
Like that is, Bill Paxton is that vampire in this film.
Yep.
And he's so great at it.
I guess I loved it as a Western. I didn't love it as a vampire film. The vampire stuff was what was driving me crazy. The rest of it I was loving.
Yeah.
I think too, though, when you talk about the, like, Adrian Pazdar, who plays Caleb, and May, when you're up against two people like Paxton and Henriksen who are chewing the scenery in a good way, like they are over the top, they are, there's no, you can't compete with that. You've got two of the best character actors of all time right there. You're always going to get overshadowed. And this movie is remembered more for them rather than the love story between Caleb and May. And I would, and again, I think it's like, I love this movie. This is my favorite vampire movie.
Mm.
But I would, again, would rather just watch them driving around feeding on people in country towns, right, yeah, and get rid of Adrian Pazdar completely.
Yeah.
But I do love this film.
It was the more important. I feel like the love story was the story that was kind of sandwiched in, or yeah, when they started acting it out and when they started reading it out and planning it, they were like, this is much more fun. It's there, but it's very much. But let's be real. Just like in a Western, that's exactly, the love story is not the, this is what I mean. Like, I look at it, I see it as a Western. Because the love story is there to facilitate everything else. And that's exactly what happened here.
Yeah.
And, that's why I just, you know, I'm like, I looked at that narrative tone and structure and went, yeah, it fits it too.
I love the way it's shot too. The way that's, you know, the day scenes are sort of kind of boring, but when it gets to the night and when the vampires are supposed to be out and alive, it's this beautiful, like, light blue, smoky,
and that's
it's gorgeous
hard to do with that kind of scenery and settings and everything. When you're in the city and stuff, it's so much easier, like, to be able to set that visual. I did love the analogy or juxtaposition of when he's still not eating and she's letting him feed off him, and then you've got the oil pumps in the background. It works to it in a really strong way.
That's a good point. I hadn't actually thought about that. This film manages to make daylight look dull and nighttime look vibrant, which is really quite clever.
It's beautifully
shot. I would agree with that. I also really like the scene where Caleb is first starting to turn and he's stumbling through the desert. There's just a really beautiful long shot of, like, the sun slowly rising behind him and just the sort of shadow of this figure stumbling across the desert with, like, the dust and smoke coming off his skin blowing out behind him. There's some really nice shots. It's look, I enjoyed it, but I also understand the
it's definitely got flaws,
the criticisms, but I did really enjoy it. And it's funny, I'd never thought about the fact, it seems obvious now, that this is a Western as much as a vampire film. And maybe that's where they went wrong, is in blending those two genres. They just didn't quite get that balance
I don't think they went wrong. I don't think it was wrong to balance them together. I don't think you can balanced. But
you don't?
I don't. And because I think a lot of films try to do that and then do a disservice to both. Let's be real. These are two very different genres. To be able to marry them in this way, I think is really great. One is going to have to feel like a bit more of a disservice to another. There is no two way about it. But I feel like if it had gone more vampire-y, then it would have taken away from the elements of a Western. And they are the elements that made this rock. Like, really, for me, it's that tone, that story. That's what allowed the characters to be so such caricatures. But if it had been more vampiristic and horror, then we would have needed them to be completely different, and that would have taken away from it in a massive way.
My favorite part too, or one of my favorite parts in the movie, is there's just a little throwaway line where, I can't remember if it's Lance Henriksen or Bill Paxton says the other one, remember that fire we started in Chicago? And it's a link. So to say that they started the Great Chicago Fire in 1912 or something. And it's like, it's a throwaway line. And he goes, I remember that. And then that's it. And if you don't really look into it, you sort of go, oh, okay. But it's actually, they set this massive, they burnt down most of Chicago.
But the thing that kind of works is it makes sense, a traveling family, like if you're going to have the family of vampires traveling around, putting them in the desert in a Western, like you, the minute you see it, you don't need a further explanation. That's what I love about it. Like, it fits the narrative so well.
Yep. Also, this is going to seem like a random note, but did anyone else feel like Bill Paxton's character was modeled off Ryan Adams in the 90s, or that perhaps Ryan Adams got his style from Bill Paxton's character?
The other way around. I think Ryan Adams, absolutely. Yeah.
It's very Ryan Adams. I was like, the shaggy hair and the sunnies and like the ripped denim with the patches with bits of cowboy stuff. I was like, this is looking very familiar to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very much.
And I'm going to say I miss Bill Paxton in movies.
He's great.
Agreed.
There are not so many celebrity deaths that that upset me. And when I heard that he died, that was one of those ones where I went, no, that's a massive loss to the film industry, because he was a phenomenal actor, but he was also a writer and a director. And, we talk of, like, Frailty is one of the is an amazing movie if people haven't seen it. And it is just so good. Mm. And he wrote and directed that, and people need to see it. And so I just, even in small parts, he is always, he's never bad in a movie. He's, he showed up in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for a few episodes, and he was awesome in that. Like, he's just, you know, yeah, it's really sad that he's gone.
Yeah, it is.
Agreed.
It is. Well, on that somber note, should we jump over to the last film for this episode?
Definitely.
This was my choice, and I'm going to say that I don't have a favorite vampire movie, and I really, really, as you two know, it took me ages to settle on one. I really struggled to pick one because there's just a lot of really good vampire films out there.
Yeah.
But in the end, I decided you just simply can't talk about vampire films without talking about The Lost Boys. Because
absolutely.
I feel like it's a classic, maybe not a classic horror film, but a classic vampire film.
It's up there.
It's up there, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty up there. So
I feel very lucky to have been a young person and to watch this vampire film, you know what I mean, as a young person.
Yeah. Well, all right, well, Shuri, do you want to give us the IMDb for The Lost Boys?
So after moving to a new town, two brothers discover that the area is a haven for vampires.
Yeah.
The other ones are really, really long.
That's the best. But let's be real. The reason this is the best casting...
It's so good.
There aren't casts that have a better looking cast. Like, really, they are all very good looking people.
Yeah. But everyone hits their notes.
Yeah.
Everyone hits
their notes. Kiefer Sutherland is just one of the best villains in anything. Like, yep. I just think that's his lane and he should just stay there. But I will say, okay, so I have a funny backstory to this film, and it's a little bit similar to my Child's Play story. I didn't fear Wii over this film. However, this is one of those films. There were a few films when I was a kid that came out that I didn't see this when I was a kid, but I heard all about it. Other kids my age had seen it. They were too young, but they'd seen it, and my dad watched it. And I'd heard so much about this movie when I was really young and too young for it. I got a complex about this movie and I felt like it was just going to be the most terrifying thing ever, like terrified of it before I'd even fucking seen it. I only saw The Lost Boys for the first time a few years ago.
Wow.
I had literally held on to this fear for so long, and I was finally like, no, watch it. It can't be that scary. You're older now and you love horror. Watch it. And so watching it again for this podcast was the second time I've ever seen it.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's so that's my history with this film. And I actually love it.
Such a brilliant film.
Now that I've seen it a couple of times, I'm like, this is a great film. I mean, also the soundtrack to this film is just brilliant. But yeah, Kiefer Sutherland, so I was saying this last night watching it with Bon, I think what makes him such a fantastic villain is that he's the bad boy. He's bad, but he's sexy. You hate him, but you love him.
You understand why a person falls under his spell.
Yes. He's dangerous, so and therefore perfect as a vampire. Made for him.
Yep.
And I didn't realize as well until recent years that this film is meant to be funny as well. I had the complex that I had since I was a child. No idea this was meant to be funny, and now I watch it and I'm like, fucking.
I mean, it's very much a horror comedy. Yeah,
it's so 80s. It is like it feels like every stereotypical John Hughes 80s film mushed together, but as a horror as well. Mm-hmm. Like everything about it is like the cast, the narrative, the clothes, the soundtrack, the clothes. My God.
But this is what I love about it is, I mean, what makes a good horror? Let's be really real. What makes something a really good horror? It's when the production team.
The fashion.
When the production team go, but from production team, from sound and music to all of it, to visuals and all of it, everyone has a very specific vision and then ramps it up. Like what makes horror great is never just here's the vision. It's not about sitting within this normal setting. Everything has to have a really specific tone that complements each other. And just like when we're looking at films with the dark and the grey and this goes the opposite way and it nails it completely, like in every level.
Absolutely. And even like the cinematography, I hadn't really thought about it, but Vaughn commented on this because she watched it with me. She's seen this film heaps. So we were watching it together and as it started, she was like, oh, you know, even the opening to this film is fantastic. She was like, the fact that the way it opens is that like that different subjectivity. You're from the point of view of the vampire. Like you don't realize it to begin with, and then you realize you're seeing the world through their eyes as they're flying above the, you know, Santa Monica Pier with the fairgrounds
Santa Clara.
And everything. Or Santa Clara, sorry. Over the Santa Clara Pier with the fairgrounds. And I was like, that's true, actually. It's really beautiful kind of
Time that technique is used throughout the film, it's just golden, whether it's all of them running into the house because they're scared, or whether it's the security guard running away. Like, it's just great. Yep. But I mean, one of the things that drives me crazy about this film is it built up, the two things that built unrealistic expectations for me are any boardwalk carnival of any kind, like they're never that much fun, and also take away Asian food. Two of the things that drive me nuts is the fact that
you're eating maggots,
like,
Michael.
They're maggots, and I'm like, it's plain rice. It's never at least
oh my God,
rice.
Yes,
with
when it fell over, I was
something.
Like,
and I'm
it's
like,
just
who
rice.
Has steamed rice in a box? Like, that is ridiculous.
What kind of, you mix it with something else.
No. But the mix should not in those kind of boxes. The mix should be in it. And
yeah,
then
exactly.
The other's like, oh, they're just noodles, and the noodles look like worms. Like,
I feel like any.
I
feel like any Asian takeaway, if some fucking white kid came and just ask for steamed rice in a box, they'd be like, get out. I'm not giving you just plain rice. That's
they give them maggots.
No, I agree.
That's what killed me. When it falls,
rice?
I'm just like, no peas, not a little bit of egg mixed in. Like, come on.
There's nothing. Where's the like Mongolian beef that you're mixed in with that rice? No, I completely agree. My lost boy
every time.
Yeah. No, the little lost boy story I was going to mention in a text chat a while back was so Us, you might know the story already.
Yes.
The Jordan Peele film Us. Have you seen that,
yep.
Dean?
I haven't seen it yet, but that's all right.
Okay.
Keep on rolling.
No,
it's right at the start anyway.
Yeah, this won't be a spoiler. It starts on the Santa Clara Pier, and they're at a fairground, and it's the beginning of the film is set in the same year that The Lost Boys was filmed. And there's a point where one of the characters says to another one something about like, oh, yeah, I think they're filming something over there. And it's meant to be a reference to people filming The Lost Boys.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So it's not set in The Lost Boys world. It's set in the real world where someone is filming, they're filming The Lost Boys in the background, which is a really, really cool little nod.
The thing that I kind of love about The Lost Boys as well is, unlike other films, the other two films where we're talking about Eternal Life, and this is where they've been in the past, they're vampires of their time. Like,
they've adapted.
And that's
more.
What I love about it. Like, well, it doesn't, they could have been bitten a year ago, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a stress, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
That's a good point, actually.
That's a good point. They're very much of their time.
And
it even shows that the head vampire has adapted because of, you know, spoilers for the movie, he's working in a video shop, you know, which is at the time, whereas you don't know how old he actually could be,
and how great is it that the twist is that the head vampire is the granddad from
Gilmore Richard Gilmore, and his like, sorry, I know this isn't an important part of the narrative, but the clothes, like, I love how it really captured the fact that in the 80s you had such a like mingling of different subcultures that all coexisted.
Yeah.
So you have these Miami Vice looking kids with the baggy pastel shirts and the white pants and the gelled hair. And then next to them, a goth with like a mohawk and like lace,
and that was
kind of the new romantics goth, like the lace gloves. And like, I was just like, this is what the 80s was. Like,
We're talking about like music, you know, saying that, you know, Interview the Vampire is the chamber music and the Near Dark is the punk rock heavy metal. Mm. This is the hair metal movie. You look at the vampires, they're the hair metal guys.
New romantics as well when I think about the soundtrack itself. But the look, do you know what? There's so much about this movie that I love and laugh at in a loving way. There's one of the vampires, it's the one with the long blonde hair. There's a point when they go to their lair and he's kind of like dancing around on the table in their lair. And I swear to God, it is like he's a cross between Jareth from Labyrinth and the lead singer of fucking Whitesnake. I'm like, look at this guy with his like skin tight pants and his long boots and his long hair, like prancing around.
Fantastic.
This is fucking hilarious, and I love it. Like,
it's so good. Yeah. And I love as well that it's told from the eyes of this family, that they all just work so well in the most crazy family dynamic. And sure, he put up a tweet about it, but he's absolutely right. Shori, you're like a day or two off from being the granddad.
Oh, sure.
Being the 100%. Granddad.
A day or two.
Yeah, that's me.
A day or two. Like, okay. Not a year. He was like a year or two, and I'm like, a year. Like, hello.
I feel
you're
like
there. It's fine.
Don't touch my double stuffed Oreo cookies in my room.
I feel
root
like
beer.
You
leave
probably need to be smoking a lot more weed to be like.
I know. I reckon Shory's nearly there. It's like Shory and Widow, the old Widow Johnson, you know? Like,
yeah. Because that was one thing that, ooh, again, Von and I were,
it's a bit
were laughing
like, don't
about.
Touch my stuff and don't touch this. And but well, the kooky dad jokes.
I've got a TV guide. Don't need a TV.
Yeah, that actually, yeah, I can see how you are kind of like him. But it was hilarious. There's a scene where like the kids, they look at, they one of them, you know, points out the back window to like the marijuana plant, and he's like winking at his brother and like gesturing, like smoking. And Von and I just like, if you needed to eyeball the marijuana plant to realize your granddad is on the chuff, then you are just not, yeah, you're not reading the room.
But like, I love,
yeah, look at this guy.
I love it. Like, but it's that from that first scene, like playing Jed at the start. I can see, yep, Shory doing that. And yeah, then stealing Jed, and then going, and scaring them. And it's like, oh, Dad. And it's, yeah, just, yep, like, I love it. And that first scene, I'm like, this
even
is
just
Shory.
The end of it when he just goes, Shory, you know, everything's happened and, you know, they've killed the head vampire and everything's over.
Oh my God, yes, the ending.
Goes, this is what I hated about this town. There's always these fucking vampires around.
Yes.
And like,
I love
you
it.
Say something from the start.
It's the perfect
ending. And that's just the end of the film.
Ending.
That's it. Yeah. I actually didn't notice that the first time I watched it. And this time I was like, that's fucking brilliant.
It's so good.
And it so works for his character that he would just have known this all along and been like, yeah, what do you mean?
Of course.
Yeah,
but I love the lore that exists within it. Like the way they romanticize it, the way, and this is the use of music and visuals. It's just friggin' beautiful. This film is done so well.
There's a scene once, because I've seen it a few times, and once you know who the head vampire is, there's the night when he comes around to take the mum out for a date or come over for the date.
I know what
and
you're
he says
say.
To Michael, he goes,
"Yeah,
oh, well, you're the man of the house. I shouldn't come in until you invite me in." Yeah. And Michael goes, "You're invited in." He goes, "Thank you." And you're like, that's it. There it is.
Yeah.
You know, you've just. You know,
I noticed that the second
Buffy,
time watching it. I was
it.
Like,
we know the
but you don't, and that's the beauty of it. You don't notice it the first time. Like, it's just, it's great. It's disarming and it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really good. But it's nice when you
but
watch
even
like
the
this,
way it's
yeah.
shot, that beautiful scene when the dog is attacking her when she's bringing the wine and it's walking down. And it's just, but the way it's shot is just fantastic. Like, the way they use wide-angle lenses in this is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And think about it. At that time, it's not like they had drones or anything. Like, these shots were set up and filmed this way. Like, it's brilliant.
They're all crane shots, yeah.
And again, as we've touched on this already, but the frustration at the main character refusing to embrace his vampire identity. Although, can I ask you guys?
Well, we have three of them that refuse to embrace their vampire identity.
Mm.
Yes. But can I just say, did anyone notice the brother who gets turned at the start? Did he get bit?
Michael.
No. So, and this is the other infuriating.
Because I didn't actually see him. I'm like,
Justin drank David's blood. That's it.
Right. That's
in the bottle.
In the bottle. So if you drink the blood of a vampire, it's not the reality of when we look at vampire lore, it's that they drain part of your blood and then replace it with their own.
Yeah.
This is saying he drank it, so therefore the replacement. And that always drives me a little bit crazy.
Yeah, because I was watching it like, hang on, have I missed something? Like, when did he get bitten?
It's just in this lore, it's a different thing.
Yeah, okay.
Shits
all right.
me every time.
I'll allow it. Yeah, but it is frustrating again to watch him, you know, resist. Although I love the scene.
But it's so cute, like when he's in the bathroom and the bath scene and everything, like the way and it's like, does your brother sleep in all day, wear sunglasses? Does he have bad breath? And he's like, yeah, but that could be anything.
He's a teenager.
I love the interaction between the brothers. Like
the Frog
I love
brothers.
When
oh no the
I feel bad for Edgar just never, like, Edgar's there, but he's just not. Poor Edgar is the actor that isn't named Corey. And it's just, I always forget that he's in the show.
I think the interactions between the two main brothers are some of my favorite scenes. Like when the older brother Michael is sleeping in and his mum calls and he opens the blinds and he's like, can you give me my sunnies? And he's like, you need your sunnies to talk on the phone? Like, it's such a brother comment.
The dynamic is brilliant.
And when he's like hovering at his window after he discovers that Michael is a vampire, and he's like, I'm not a monster. And he's like, oh, what are you, the flying nun? Because he's just hovering outside his window. It's like, you're clearly a vampire, dude.
But what's cool is this family relationship that they establish, it just carries all the way through. It's really great.
Yeah.
You know, even, and the thing with the Frog Brothers that's hilarious, like when they do go in, I mean, I'm sorry, vampires are sleeping at night. They go into their den and scream during the day. Like, it's just like, you guys are terrible at this. They're making so much noise that I wouldn't be surprised if someone bit you.
It's like the Goonies with vampires.
Yes.
But what was the line? Emma, I think you said that line, it was the, you're a shit-sucking vampire, Michael. Wait till I tell Mum.
Yeah.
That was Dean. It's like Mum's going to be so mad.
This is a film filled with body dysmorphia and all this different stuff. And then it's just like, you're a vampire. You wait till Mum finds out. And it's like, that line is amazing.
My mum would have been cut if she found out that I was a vampire.
It is a horror comedy, but it's not a comedy. Like, this is what I love about it. The way in which it's set up. And, you know, when I think of horror comedies, I think of Shaun of the Dead. I think of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which a part of me is like, God, I can't believe we didn't do the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. How dare you?
No. And I like it. I just think we picked better movies.
But it's that thing where I'm just like, you know, that mix of comedy, it works so well here.
It really
does. Laugh at a line, but the terror doesn't drop with the comedy. Like the tension sits there. You're laughing, but the tension needle has not moved, and it just keeps ramping up. And what I love about this film is it ramps up and it stays where it sits. And then it keeps going, and it's like, and when we hit that point, that for me, every time I watch it, I'm like on the edge of my seat with a giant smile on my face, staring at the screen, is when they've killed the vampire after being in it. They know that they're all coming to the house. They've set up the house appropriately, and then they go to get Nanook. And they get the dog and they're running back and everyone's standing at the doorway screaming, hurry up, come back. And they can see the vampires coming and you cut for the and that's the scene for me. Like, the tension of the whole film just ramps up to that moment. And I just, every time I watch it, I'm like, oh my God, filming this scene would have been so much fun for all of them, because it's just so cool and the tension is so great. And that's what I love. The comedy is great. Mm. The visuals and tone is great. The music is great. And the tension just never stops. Which is why when we get that ending where it's that dad joke comment and we get that ending, it's like, how else could this film end? And it's the fridge door closing on all of their faces looking tired. And it's the perfect ending to this film.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, I love that I convinced myself to actually visit this movie after I'd been scarred by the very notion of it as a child, because as an adult, I'm like, hell yes, I really appreciate what this is now. Like, I love that it's everything that you just said, Dean. Like, it is scary and that tension does stay at a really high level, but it's also funny. The funny bits are perfectly timed. They're perfect little moments of relief, like from the tension. And it's just, and I was just sort of thinking as you were saying this, like, there's something about 80s films where they were able to capture the dynamic of siblings really well. And maybe families more broadly, but it's particularly siblings, that kind of antagonistic, but still, I still love you, bro or sis or whatever.
I mean, like, it was very much a narrative of the time. Like, when you think about it, we don't have that narrative anymore. And it was a very, that relationship within a film, that's all the films. Like, absolutely. Yeah.
But this is also, and it's one of those things I bring up all the time too. This is, for a lot of kids in the 80s as well, was a gateway horror movie too, because it's not overly bloody. It's not overly scary. It's tense, but it's not, you know, jump scares every 5 minutes. It's not, there's no nudity. There's a little bit of sexy stuff, but it's nothing really. It's a blue light and they roll around on a bed, but it's a gateway horror. It's one of those ones where you go, this is a great movie to show somebody who's 13 years old.
I love how when you describe, every now and again we'll watch something and you're talking about how it's a great gateway horror for kids. And I'm just sitting here thinking, I would have literally wet the bed if I tried to watch this as a gateway horror. I love like that your tolerance level is so, and but also I guess that's the point. All kids are different. This was
come on, Emma,
not
I watched Jaws
a gateway
six.
Horror for me.
Yeah.
No, this would have scared the poop out of me if I watched it too young.
DVD, this film was the third DVD I ever bought.
Nice.
Wow.
And I love it, and I've still got it. And I'm just I love it so much. It's just amazing. And at the time, I was just like, hello, Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, God. Weren't we all? Well, me as an adult 5 years ago, because that's the only time I watched it. Yeah, maybe not Shuri, but you know.
Oh, no, but the woman that Michael goes after.
Oh, you know what I love as well.
As an actress, she's been in so many things, but as an actress as well, one of the things that kills
Jamie
me.
Jamie Gertz.
Yeah, and as she's gotten older, she gets put into roles where she's the uptight woman.
Yeah.
And she's great at it, especially in sitcom comedy. She's really good. But, oh, my God, she just hits the nail. She's such a good actress, and she's beautiful and hits the nail on the head. Like, brilliant casting in this film. Absolutely brilliant casting across the board. It's so good.
Can we talk about, like, the casting of the standout character, which is obviously the oiled-down saxophone man? Like,
we mentioned it. How did it take us this long?
Wow. Like, can you just imagine if you will, I'm watching this film for the first time only a couple of years ago, and I've got a complex about it from when I was a kid. I'm watching it and it's not long into the, because it's near the start of the film, but it gets to that. And I was just like, what the fuck am I? No one told me about this.
Like, and there's a crowd of that size watching a guy sing and play the saxophone with no breathing in a giant, like a roided muscle man with a slick back ponytail.
Oh my God.
In tight pants. And it's just
you're watching these like throngs of women in the crowd, like
were they women?
Him.
Men had the same hairstyle.
Well, who knows? They said they looked like women, and they were kind of adoring him. And one of us said something about like, you know, like crazy during like that time, like that they were really into that. And I was like, I'm going to be completely honest. I don't think that guy's batting for the right team for those women to be into him.
I reckon he's batting for both teams. He goes for whatever comes to his.
That looks
turns
very,
up in his trailer.
Yeah. I don't know. The oiled down body and the chain mail choker. So and the, I'm like, I don't know what's going
song,
on there.
That song is a banger. That song is really good. I put it on playlists all the time. It is
honestly
a great song.
I don't even remember the song because I'm just so distracted by that fantastic spectacle of the
I'll
of
send
the
you the YouTube link
player.
To the actual song.
Look, I'm actually tempted to go and just listen to the soundtrack from The Lost Boys at some point because it's...
Oh, I've got that also. It's great.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
we have to mention
it's got Jimmy Barnes and INXS on it.
Yes. I noticed that there's two Jimmy Barnes songs actually. There's one when he goes into the comic book shop, and then there's
Terrible. As a comic book reader, I'm offended by the entire comic book narrative in this film. It angers me on every level. Like you can't put Superman here because and it just makes me angry. And I'm like, this is how my father thought I was when I walked into a comic book store. I wasn't. But it's like, oh, it drives me crazy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like something the kids can be dedicated about.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was a great film.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's amazing.
Really
yeah.
enjoyed it. Sexy Sax Man is just like the icing on the cake. It's just that little thing that did they mean that to be funny? I don't know.
I think with this whole film, I think they were absolutely putting a satirical lens to it. I don't know if
tongue firmly in cheek the whole time.
Yeah, the tongue is firmly in cheek, but I don't think they meant it as the joke that we see it as.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. Like, I mean, it was just everything's at an 11 in this film. So
well,
we
and
tell.
Also it
like,
was
and,
the
and
80s.
It's that juxtaposition of the boardwalk is this massive hub of activity. Mm. And then every other space is so quiet, but the extremes of it, who knows?
I will say, Dean, I don't know that this film does actually set unrealistic expectations for peer-based festivals. In the US. I think in the US.
No, for a boardwalk carnival.
Sorry, for a boardwalk carnival.
Really?
But in the US, I think.
I've been in Europe. I've been in Australia. Yeah, I've never seen that kind of. There were 12 people playing the the bloody water gun thing into it. It was just like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Can I just say?
Everything was so full. I was just like, calm down.
This is true. Definitely pre-COVID.
Oiled Up Saxophone Man is listed in the credits as Beach Concert Star.
Beach Concert Star. Who is this guy? Does his name have a name?
Tim Capello.
What does Tim do nowadays?
Let's talk about Cameo.
Is he still getting oiled up? Where's my phone?
Cameo. We should absolutely get a shout out from Tim.
What's Cameo?
What we're going to do.
Cameo is this thing where you pay a person $20 or something to do a video, celebrities. And it's like you can get dragged. Well, they're not all celebrities. Like
if he can oil up and play saxophone for us, we'll buy a cameo from him.
So Tim Capello.
I mean, I'm okay without the oil.
Tim Capello is primarily known for his saxophone work supporting Tina Turner in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So he has done some really awesome stuff.
Love it.
Oh my gosh. Oh, and it looks like he's well into, I don't think he wore that outfit just for the film. Just saying.
Maybe like, that was his whole thing.
That's the impression I'm getting.
Wow. I love it.
Google Embrace image. It.
Everyone jump onto Google and go down to Tim Capello. We'll put a link in the description and in the description of everything as well. I mean, if you can see M's face right now, she's looking at different pictures. It's amazing.
I'm about to send you guys a picture, which is clearly a more recent image, and he's still embracing the look.
Everyone, dive into your internet hole and just have a look and find it, because this is going to be fun.
Wow,
I am very happy with our bloodsucker choices for these.
Yeah,
films.
Me too.
Like we
definitely tapped that vein.
Yeah, guys, I can't keep up. I don't think in puns.
You suck.
Damn it! I know.
You just got to really sink your teeth in and take a bite out of it, Em.
Fuck off! I got nothing.
But you know what? Fangs for being such a good sport with this one.
I hate you both.
Oh, my God, sorry, I've just seen the picture that Emma sent. Yes, he absolutely still embraces. Wow,
he still rocks it. He still embraces it.
Absolutely.
And I will just say, even though, like, I think we picked three amazing films and each with a slightly different tone, I know that people listening to this are going to be like, but what about blah? What about blah? And I just want to say, we know. It was so hard. And
we are fully aware that there are
some fantastic vampire movies that we just couldn't get across because there's just too much.
Let us know your favourites on the social as well.
Exactly. Let us know because we're open to doing some follow-up episodes sometime in the future, perhaps, where we look at things that we missed. Mm-hmm. One thing I will mention, so one of the films that I was thinking of looking at was What We Do in the Shadows, which is very much a comedy. But I don't know if you guys have seen it or anyone who's listening is familiar with it, but there's a scene in What We Do in the Shadows, which is a direct riff off the scene in The Lost Boys where they give him the Chinese takeout and it turns into maggots or it turns into worms, except in What We Do in the Shadows, they serve them dinner and they go, would you like some bruschetta? And it's like spaghetti and he goes to eat it. And it's actually worms. And when we were watching this scene in The Lost Boys, we just couldn't handle it. Like as soon as it came on, Von was like, oh, Michael, would you like some bruschetta? I was like, no, it's ruined for me. It's ruined. Like,
love it.
So if you haven't seen What We Do in the Shadows, because we couldn't cover it, New Zealand vampire comedy. Yep.
Oh, it's definitely
brilliant. Taika Waititi one to watch.
Taika Waititi, yeah. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant film.
Well, that's it for our vampire horror podcast. We're deep diving into the monster films now, and we have another new category for you tomorrow.
So wait and see.
So yeah,
you're going to have to wait and see. We'll see you tomorrow. Yeah. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Probably not seen. Bye.
Hey, everybody, it's Dean. I hope you love talking vampires as much as we did. We're not joking when we say we want to hear your picks for what vampire films we should have covered. We love hearing from you on the socials at Pod of the Damned on Twitter and Podcast of the Damned on Instagram. Honestly, we're just happy that people are enjoying this as much as we are. So much so that we're doing something special for our final episode on October 31st. We're letting you pick the film that we watch. Shori M and I have each picked three films that we would love to watch, and we are letting you, our listeners, pick which one we're going to talk about. The polls have already been open for one day, and we've gotten some great picks from all around the world. You know what? I just love knowing that New Mutants not our only American listener. It just surprised me and got me really excited. But there are two films that are starting to cut ahead when it comes to which ones are going to be in the lead. But at the end of the day, whichever you pick to be on top is going to be the one that we're going to talk about. So jump over to our website, podofthedam.com, hit the EP31 poll in the menu, and it'll scroll right down to the bottom of our listening page where you can pick the film. We've got Cabin in the Woods, House on Haunted Hill, I Know What You Did Last Summer, Young Frankenstein, The Faculty, Ready or Not, Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, Messiah of Evil, and Scare Me. Honestly, any of these would be fantastic, so we can't wait to find out what you're going to pick. At midnight on the 28th of October is when the polls close, so you've got to get your votes in then. Why not cast your vote right now? And we'll see you tomorrow for a fantastic new monster theme. I wonder what it could be. Ow! Honestly, it's 6:55 in the morning and I just thought I'd try to do that sound effect, and who knows how worked out. My brain really is just there. I'm going to be uploading this podcast in 2 seconds. I hope you enjoy it.